Steve Mirsky here with part two of our talk with Graham Farmelo, author of Churchill's Bomb. In terms of the effort to separate the uranium, I mean, it's a brute force kind of thing. If you just do it long enough and make the separation tubes big enough and use enough uranium, you can do it. How long? I mean, the idea is that the uranium isotopes are a slightly different weight.
That's right.
And when you vaporize them, one will travel down the tube slightly further than the other.
That's right.
And that's how you can separate them. But how long were the tubes that?
I can't tell you the exact size, but this was a vast. It's not even thinkable now because you'd see them from aerial satellites.
Right.
I mean, they were building whole towns to do this.
Separate out the uranium isotope.
I know. And as you rightly say, it was absolutely brute force. And I'm lost for words. It was to produce the amount of fissile uranium and also plutonium. America definitely took the lead on that, right? Because it turned out it was you needed less of that particular chemical element. Americans were quickly took the lead in developing plutonium weapons so that they could had enough fissile material to build a small number of nuclear bombs right at the end, as it turned out, of the war. And that was, in its macabre way, it was a complete triumph for Oppenheimer, but also, let's be clear, for General Groves,
right,
who I don't think I would have got on particularly well with, not that that matters. I suspect he's a very, very tough guy to work with. But it was an absolutely phenomenal planning achievement to have got those weapons ready. In fact, they had the Trinity test, and then they were able to give the president the results of the Trinity test just in time for Potsdam, which is when Harry Truman informed Stalin that the nuclear bomb had been was ready. And of course, Stalin was a really great actor there. He said, "Oh, really?" You know, and of course, he'd been briefed on this for years. He'd been getting briefings from London, which would have made Churchill blanche. You know? But as I say, the outcome is really, I think for most people, a very sad one, because people will never agree about nuclear weapons in the sense that some people say that they blight the earth, other people will say that it's given us a long-standing peace. But whatever you think about it, a colossal amount of wasted effort was put in building up these ever larger arsenals, when perhaps a more imaginative approach would have been more productive. We have to bear in mind, again, we know that good people will differ on this, but I think it's fair to say that anyone, but I think with any sensibility, will think it's an appalling thing to wipe out tens of thousands of people. But one has to bear in mind that a comparable number of people were killed in one night's firebombing of Tokyo.
And Dresden as well, I believe.
Absolutely fair point. And the people then, at that time, you could look at George Orwell, my own mother, still alive, right, will say the relief that they had because the war was over. Right now, there's all sorts of perspectives you can take on that. I said we just have to. As Bohr would have appreciated this. There's no unique way of looking at this thing, but it was a momentous tale of where scientists and politicians had to come together. And it's worth thinking. I think that of how strange this was, that the most advanced scientists in one field, seen as a very, very recondite area, came together with scientists. It's almost like, if you like, today's string theorists were suddenly finding themselves working with Obama, David Cameron, and Putin, and what have you.
Right?
It's really like something out of science fiction.
Yeah. You
know, I think it's unprecedented to have such a large scale working together. Going back to that point about how the public before the war had read, had seen plays on Broadway in London, Wings Over Europe. They read books by people like Harold Nicholson, big-selling books by J.B. Priestley, big-selling book in the United States, like 1938, right, where people were talking about nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. right? And the physicists, it has to be said, the physicists were poo-pooing this. Most of all, the greatest nuclear physicist probably of them all, Ernest Rutherford, you know, the classic nuclear skeptic. You know, you're talking about moonshine, well, the idea that you could actually make a bomb and you could tap this nuclear energy. And then it all goes quiet in the war. Next thing they do, they read the newspaper and a nuclear bomb's been built. You can understand this, the public disorientated how disorientated they were by this, you know, because in a sense the H.G. Wellses and the Priestleys and the poets and the writers had forewarned people about this.
Yep.
You know,
when you wrote the book, when you did the research for the book, what really jumped out at you as something you didn't know, didn't expect?
Well, there are several anecdotes that caught me by surprise. I must say, the one that tickles me most was this. And let me give a very quick bit of background, that Churchill is often seen as a kind of scientific illiterate. But he was seen by people in his cabinet as being, because he knows nothing about science. He just relies on Lindemann. Right? Had no interest at all in basic science. So I came across this report, and I did quite a bit of research on it, where in March 1933, Churchill chaired a discussion about the modern discoveries in nuclear physics. This is the first artificial splitting of the atom, the discovery of the neutron, right, and the cosmic ray showers, which gave a beautifully vivid picture of antimatter freshly discovered in the United States. Churchill was talking really quite lucidly and in his witty way, right, about these discoveries. He had just published 50 years hence, where he was looking forward to nuclear weapons. So it's astounding to me that this writer, who is so literary, right, and so unscientific, allegedly, was in fact on top of this stuff in the 1930s. And I remain deeply admiring of his breadth of interest, you know, and his farsightedness. To me, as a nuclear visionary, he was far greater as a journalist than he was as a politician.
Mm-hmm.
One other point that fascinated me was that Churchill, I think it was 1947, he actually advocated, when he was talking to Mackenzie King, the Canadian leader, a preemptive strike on the Soviet Union.
Hmm.
That was the high point of his bellicosity, so to speak. He was deeply, deeply troubled by Stalin's, what Churchill saw as Stalin's belligerency, particularly in Eastern Europe. Events quickly took over. The Soviets got the bomb. They then got the H-bomb, which is a super-duper version of the atomic bomb. And then in 1954, Churchill had this sort of Damascene moment when he read the appalling, unutterably appalling destructiveness of the hydrogen bomb. In a report he read in the Manchester Guide, we've got a report, we know someone that actually saw him read that newspaper, right? And he realized, so to speak, the game was up. This was ridiculous, you know. Both sides could absolutely smash each other to bits. And he saw in this an imperative to end the Cold War. Right, that he felt he had to take a lead in this, and that's what made him a pioneer of détente right at the end of his career, mm-hmm. when he was urging Eisenhower and he was urging the Soviet leaders, Stalin, because Stalin died in 1953, to come together to avoid what he saw as a likely cataclysm. That wasn't successful. It was undoubtedly a failure of his, but historians disagree on this, but I personally find it actually rather thrilling that someone of that age, right, 80 years old, 1954, right, could still, you know, be imaginative, right, way after it would have been great if he'd been more imaginative in the war, but he still was taking imaginative action about nuclear weapons. And you know, Steve, this people might say, well, you know, he had to be involved in the Second World War. It's curiosity that he was involved in the 1930s. Afterwards, he wouldn't have given a damn about it. That's not true. After he left office, he was kept briefed on Britain's nuclear arrangements. He visited Britain's nuclear research establishment in Harwell. And believe it or not, he participated in a nuclear experiment when he was aged 80.
What did he do?
Well, Sir John Cockcroft, one of the two guys who first artificially split the atom, took him to this neutron scattering experiment, and Churchill was being briefed by Cockcroft and others, and he was the person who turned off this neutron beam. So it was an absolutely minimal involvement. But the point was, he was actually in there with equipment, you know, aged 80. You know, and he was reading Neville Shute on the beach, right? This was his obsession right to the end, right? And for me, the abiding fascination of this story is that he was aware of it so early. And politicians, they say, never will come out and say, you know, I screwed up or I got this wrong. But I would dearly love to know whether he ever thought about tracing those steps. I think, as I speculate in my book, that it must have dawned on him when he gave his great speech on the 1st of March 1955, which was, by all accounts, a really great speech. Even people opposed him. And this was on Britain's acquisition of the hydrogen bomb. When he looked back on 50 years hence, he looked back on that article and he, frankly, was boasting that he and Lindemann had been anticipating events. Right, and yet nobody sought to ask, well, if you were doing that in 1931, why weren't we better prepared?
Right,
but overall, I would say that Churchill is a more impressive figure after this. It's easy to be critical, you know, from the vantage point we're in now, right? But I think that it's a remarkable story of how a politician can know about a science early and still not be able to handle it as effectively as one might hope when it comes to actually dealing with things.
Why did you write this book?
I've long been intrigued by the thought of all these nuclear physicists and theoretical physicists suddenly being swept away from their laboratories, away from all these abstractions and the subnuclear world, just ripped away from their laboratories, from their desks and easels, into the completely unfamiliar world of politics, with secrecy then prevailing rather than the openness that everyone wants to see. And that's what caught my imagination. And I knew that Churchill was involved in this. What I never expected was to find that Churchill was much more involved in science than, as far as I know, anyone really had realized. And that's what I think makes it such a rich story. And I did not know that when I started. So you could call it a lot of luck.
You spent the summer at Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study.
Indeed.
Is that to do research on your next book?
It is. It is. My thinking about my next book is so tentative that even you, Steve, shall not know its subject. But I shall be very pleased in due course to come and talk about it with you. It does not involve Winston Churchill. I'll give you that.
Okay. Well, right. Well, we hope to see you again in maybe 2 years, more like three,
yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, but it won't be 5.5. I've done 2 5.5-year books, and I think a shorter one is due this time.
Well, Dirac and Churchill are rather large subjects.
They are. Ah, good. It's a good link on that anecdote, actually. There's a good link there. In 1970, 1972, when Dirac's 70th birthday was being celebrated by people like Heisenberg and Yang and all these great people, right, were celebrating his birthday, C.P. Snow, two cultures guy, stood up and said, "We are in the presence of the greatest living Englishman," and nobody demurred, right? And of course, the reason why he was able to say that was that Churchill had died in 19 in Atlantic 65. Yeah. That's right. So you could say, right, by C.P. Snow's rather peculiar way of looking at the world, that I've looked at the, two of the century's greatest Englishmen.
Very good. Have you seen the opera, Dr. Atomic?
No. Couldn't get tickets. I was away. Have you seen it?
I saw a broadcast of it on television.
Ah.
And, you know, after watching this, I think you'd just find it fascinating.
Yeah.
Whether you'd think it's a great opera, I can't say, but I think you'd find it fascinating.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yes, I've heard people that really like that. I mean, there's no doubt that that Oppenheim is an operatic figure. I mean, for lots of reasons. I mean, that's why there's so many biographies of him. Now, they probably will continue to be. So he wasn't the world's greatest scientist, but that said, to Groves' his credit. Mm-hmm. Groves saw the potential, which hardly anyone else, as far as I know, saw, and found a really great scientific leader of that project. And that was an inspirational piece of leadership on Groves' part.
Mm-hmm. Oppenheimer, not the world's greatest physicist, but the world's greatest administrator of a gigantic physics project.
Yeah, well, of the physics of it. Remember, it was Groves who did. Yeah, it's an important distinction because Oppenheimer, he was doing the science of it. Right? That is not to belittle his contribution in any way, but you know, you have to bear in mind that Groves was the mastermind who pulled the whole thing together. And let me say, when I say he's not the world's greatest physicist, I don't mean he was in any way a poor physicist. I'm simply saying he wasn't at the same level as your Einsteins and your Diracs, and he knew that. I personally believe, for what it's worth, that he knew, he had immaculate taste, Oppenheimer. He knew who the best people were. Mm-hmm. He knew what great physics was. And he also knew he wasn't quite in that league. But he also was confident enough to try his hand at this scientific leadership. And that made him one of the greats.
Reminds me of one of the Supreme Court justices said after meeting FDR, after he had just been elected, I believe, he does not have a first-rate intellect, but he does have a first-rate temperament.
Yes. Yeah. Churchill hugely revered FDR. And I have to say, I was, just in terms of representing his country, I've been very impressed with FDR. I would have found it totally frustrating to have dealt with him, and I think Churchill often did. Mm-hmm. But an absolute master politician. I mean, he knew far less about science than Churchill did, quite plainly.
Right.
And he did a couple of courses at Harvard in geology or whatever it was. Yeah, and it was, you know, you would never see him chairing a course on the on new discoveries in nuclear. He had no Lindemann, but the decisiveness with which he went after the bomb, with which he appointed Vannevar Bush, for example, you know, who came in to kind of punch and to set up this amazing organization of American science. That was really good, impressive leadership.
And Leo Szilard famously goes to the White House with a letter from Einstein for FDR, begging him to initiate this project to make an atomic bomb. Was that indeed a crucial event in FDR's decision making?
It was important. I personally think that the understanding of how to make a bomb in crude terms, that impetus was much more important than the Einstein initiative. I'm not saying Einstein's issue was unimportant, but what was so critical and missed out of some really quite good histories is that it was in that office in Birmingham in 1940 that the Allies, broadly speaking, realized you could build a bomb, right? And Szilard did not know how to do that. He was a very brilliant person. There's no doubt about that. He's a friend of Einstein. He was very worried. Right? His intuition was right. It must be possible, so to speak. But it was Frisch and Pyles who actually wrote on pretty much on the backs of envelopes how you could do it. And that's what I think has been underestimated. And to be fair to Szilard, you know, he, with Fritsch and Pyles' boss, Oliphant, he was really pushing this in the United States, right? So all those things came together with the leading players. And as I said, the way with which the United States ran with that is awesome.
Leo Szilard, when he got out of the bathtub,
Yeah.
Could get a lot done.
He did. He was a very, very brilliant guy. But you might say they were, he was from a group of people who, he was not the brightest of them. You had, in the same school district.
John von Neumann.
Yeah. Eugene Wigner, Dirac's brother-in-law.
Right.
I mean, Pugliani, these are, there's a good book to be written. I know there have been others, but there's a good popular book to be written about how this fluke, this fluke that gave us these great Hungarian, minds.
It is quite amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. Yes, that's right.
Well, we'll let Hungary have the last word this
time. All right.
Time.
Okay. That was great.
This is great to talk to you. Churchill's Bomb, How the United States Overtook Britain in the First Nuclear Arms Race. If you like science, you'll love it. If you like history, you'll love it. If you like science and history, well,
good.
Graham Farmala, thanks so much.
Absolutely my pleasure, Steve, as always.
Well, that's it for this episode. Get your science news at our website, www.scientificamerican.com, where you can also check out the collection of Scientific American e-books. Of particular interest may be the recently published volume called The Changing Face of War. All the e-books are under $4. They're at books.scientificamerican.com/SA-ebooks. Or just go to the website and look for e-books. And follow us on Twitter, where you get a tweet whenever a new item hits the website. Our Twitter name is @SciAm. For Scientific American Science Talk, I'm Steve Mirsky. Thanks for clicking on us.
The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.